This is an FCIC interview with Blythe Masters of J.P. Morgan, Wednesday, June 16th at 2:45 p.m.
So just wanted to give you a little bit of background about the commission. I'm sure that Eric and Jessica have told you, but the commission is a bipartisan commission that was formed in May of last year to investigate the causes of the financial crisis. And one of the issues that the statute creating the commission asked it to look at was the role of complex financial derivatives in the crisis, and also asked the commission to look at institutions that would have failed but for the receipt of government assistance. So one of the entities that we're looking at in that respect is AIG, and specifically looking at their use of derivatives and the role that it played in the problems with the financial products unit there. So with that background, I wanted to just give you that, and also the reason that we asked to talk to you is, I think, because I'm sure you're aware that it's generally known that you were involved in creating the credit derivatives in the first instance, and wanted to get your perspectives on the early formation of the products, what they were originally intended for. I may also ask some questions intermittently about any dealings you had with AIG, because I understand that they were involved in writing the credit protection on deals back in the late 90s when all this first started. And so really just wanted to start there. And so to have you tell us just a little bit about your involvement in developing credit derivatives in the first instance.
Okay. Thanks for having me. I was involved in the early stages of the development of the credit derivative market. You're correct in that respect. Many publications have credited me with inventing them. It's not actually true, and I couldn't tell you who did. But I was involved in the early stages of helping to define the products, helping to educate people about their structure, the concept, working with regulators, rating agencies, and clients and the like to help them understand what was at that stage obviously a very, very new product.
And so what was the idea behind the development of the product?
The simplest way to understand a credit derivative, if you're not a practitioner, is to think of it as as analogous to a form of insurance against credit risk. Legally, it's importantly different than that, but intellectually, that's the way to think about it. And before the development of credit derivatives, the way that credit risk was transferred from party to party in the economy was based on transfer of underlying credit assets. So, for example, a bank would make a loan, and or an investor would buy a bond, and hence credit exposure would be created or transferred. The innovation that was credit derivatives was the notion that you could transfer credit risk without transferring the underlying asset itself, the underlying loan or bond or other source of credit risk.
Why wouldn't you have wanted just to transfer the loan or the underlying?
Many reasons. The simplest being that in the case of loans, those are bilateral financial contracts between two parties. And unlike securities, they're not really transferable. And so they're complex and difficult and time-consuming and expensive to transfer. But also, certain forms of credit risk are just not inherently transferable. And the ability to buy credit protection, if you will, on a risk that you have, a business risk or an ongoing exposure you have, was new. It was a uniquely new concept.
So sounds like one reason would be to transfer credit risk, and another reason would be to hedge credit risk.
Both of those, that's right, yeah.
Okay. Which are distinct. They can be distinct.
Correct.
And separate reasons,
that's correct,
too. Okay. And so the first deals that you were involved in structuring, how did they work? I mean, were they similar to what we currently know as collateralized debt obligations?
No.
No. Okay.
Very simple. So the early credit derivative transactions were basically single name corporate structures. So imagine a corporate entity, please don't quote me on this, but just to take an example, British Petroleum, since it's in the news this week.
Sure.
A buyer and a seller of a credit default would reference that company as a credit risk, and the buyer would seek to compensate the seller in order to receive, in the event of a failure by that company, a payment to a payment that would, in effect, cover their losses associated with their own business exposure to BP.
Dixie, Kim Schaefer is here in the lobby. Do you want to speak with her, or should I just show her in?
Sure, as long as that's okay.
Sure.
Great. So, early on, the single name corporate credit example that you just gave, British Petroleum, would, if you would have known, I mean, would the counterparty that was buying protection on the CDS have actually had exposure to BP, or would that have been irrelevant to the deal?
As a practical matter, the answer is yes, more often than not.
This is my colleague Kim Schaefer.
How do you do? Nice to meet you. As a practical matter, the answer is yes, more often than not, certainly at that stage of the market's evolution, buyer protection would have some motivation that was typically driven by a pre-existing exposure that could be as simple as a loan or as complex as an ongoing business relationship, that doesn't manifest itself in a credit instrument, but in the event that that partner failed, it would be material to the success of the company. As a contractual matter, the way that these contracts work, and this was the essence of the innovation here, there was no requirement for the buyer of protection to have an underlying exposure in order to enter into the contract. And that, in essence, is the simple distinction between a credit derivative and an insurance contract. An insurance contract requires the buyer to prove loss in order to be reimbursed for that loss, compensate for that loss. Excuse me, I have a bad throat.
Oh.
A credit derivative does not. A credit derivative is simply contractual arrangement. I will pay you X in the event of a defined event. You will pay me Y.
And in, you may or may not be aware of this, but in 2000, the New York State Insurance Department issued an opinion to that effect.
I recall that, yes.
Were you involved in seeking that opinion from the New York State Insurance Department?
No. I had been involved in a variety of earlier discussions with... what is the entity's name? The NAIC, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, mm-hmm. about the concept of credit derivatives. But I was not directly involved in explicitly seeking that opinion, although I remember being aware of it, and it was helpful.
Do you know if JP Morgan was involved?
I actually don't know. I would say common practice for interactions with regulators on these types of products at that stage in the market's development was the intention on the part of the experts to educate a variety of market participants, whether they be regulators, rating agencies, investors, potential hedges, end users. So therefore, it would have been commonplace for a JP Morgan to be having that type of interaction with someone like the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. I don't know specifically about the New York State Department.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think you said it was a very helpful opinion. Could you sort of give me an understanding of why that was an important point in the market, that to clarify that this isn't insurance?
Yes, so the key distinction between the two contracts is the requirement to prove loss. That's what the opinion hinged upon, if I recall correctly. And the reason why that was important was because if it were concluded otherwise, in other words, if it were concluded that a credit derivative was in fact a form of insurance, then the empowerment of entities, the legal powers of entities to enter into those contracts would have come into question, because of the whole host of insurance law that requires certain things for you to be an insurance company.
For you to be registered
Correct.
With different states
Correct.
Where you're conducting that business.
Correct. No, yeah, registration and other things, yes. Regulation. And yeah, I'm not an insurance specialist, but that's the general gist of it.
Okay. And so focusing a little bit on AIG, did you work with AIG on the early deals? Did you personally interact with people at AIG?
I did, yes.
Who at AIG, was it with the Financial Products Unit that did this?
Yes. So they were based in Connecticut, and my primary contact was an individual named Jim Wolfe, or James Wolfe. I believe he's no longer with the company, but I'm out of touch with him. And that was somebody that I had a pretty frequent interaction with regarding these products.
Okay. And so could you describe, were these the corporate single name corporate credit deals that you did with AIG?
That's where it started.
Okay.
And just to put this in context,
sure.
AIG at that stage was a market participant that was active in various forums where credit derivatives were being discussed, debated, evolved. So, for example, there were industry conferences where a variety of issues would be discussed, ranging from the product structure to questions like the insurance question that you already asked about, those types of things, and that were really intended to be, you know, information dissemination sessions, education sessions. And as I recall it, that's how I first encountered Jim Wolfe. So AIG was another professional counterparty with interest in this space, which already was involved in the derivative business. AIG Financial Products was a specialized derivative entity that did derivatives for a living.
Right.
I wouldn't have categorized them as a client in the more of a counterparty than a client in the, if you understand the nuance.
Mm-hmm. Do you know if they were involved in credit derivatives before they started doing these types of deals with JP Morgan?
I don't.
You don't know one way or the other?
No.
Okay.
They were visibly exploring, but I couldn't tell whether they had or had not done anything prior to my interaction with them.
Did you have any other interaction with other people at FP, or were there other people involved at the conferences and sort of involved in the development of this market?
The only person that I met was Joe Cassano.
Okay.
And my interaction with him was very, very limited. I think I met him in person only once, or approximately once, let's put it that way. It certainly wasn't a frequent interaction. And other than that, really no other individuals whose names I could even begin to recall.
Okay. So the deals that you've described so far seem to be simple, with one counterparty on either side.
That's right.
And no tranching or anything like
exactly.
that. Just a single swap deal. So could you take me through? Was there, at some point, obviously, deals of this type or deals that were things evolved and came to the point where they were called collateralized debt obligations, and there were all sorts of securities that underlied the CDOs on which there would be a super senior tranche that credit default swaps would be written on.
Yeah, so you.
So I'm trying to go from one end
ahead.
To the
yeah.
So, and that's why you're here, because I'd like to get an understanding of how the market evolved, because I have at this point a very decent working knowledge of where the market was from sort of 04 to 08 or 05 to 08. But I feel like there's a lot there that's missing that I'm hoping that you can help us understand.
Yeah. I should caveat everything I'm about to say, which is that my own role, thank you very much, changed in 2004.
Okay.
When I became the CFO of JP Morgan's investment bank. And at that point, I was obviously focused on other things, many things. And my role had evolved from about 2001 when I became responsible for managing the bank's global credit portfolio, which is essentially our retained exposure in the form of loans and derivative exposures to counterparties. And whilst I was a user, an end user of credit derivatives in that context, I was no longer a purveyor of them, if you see what I mean.
Starting in 2001.
Yeah. So
I see.
So okay. A lot of what I'm about to tell you, you need to understand, I'm talking about very early stage evolution, and my knowledge becomes less crisp from that point onwards.
Mm-hmm.
But I can talk to you about how we move from single name to multi-name structures and how the concepts of tranching became introduced.
Okay.
So independently of AIG or anyone else, JP Morgan was a bank and had, I'm talking about the era beginning in 98, let's say, ish. And we had a certain amount of credit exposure in our retained credit portfolios to a variety of customers of the bank that we wanted to risk manage. And we wanted to risk manage it for a variety of reasons, but the principal one was the fact that the return on risk capital or regulatory capital correlated, similar concepts, associated with those exposures was unattractive. And if we found a way to reduce the capital commitment to that business without having to abandon our client relationships, we believed we could improve the financial performance of the bank by improving our return on equity. So we started thinking about credit derivatives, and it started off with individual corporate contracts where we had a concentrated exposure to whoever, name your corporate.
Could I stop there? And is the reason that the return on capital was unattractive, was that because the interest rate was not?
Correct.
So if you'd had a higher interest rate, maybe you wouldn't have cared?
Yeah, it's possible.
Or you could have had a higher interest rate and done this anyway and made it even better.
That's also possible.
Okay.
Yeah. Basically, pricing is exactly right. So,
okay.
In that era, JP Morgan was competing with investment banks whose return on equity would be in the 20 to 30% zip code, and the return on equity associated with traditional high-grade corporate lending was definitely single digits, definitely less than 10. Take a number, but not attractive. And one of the reasons for that was that the regulatory capital framework didn't distinguish between high-quality risks and low-quality risks. So if you think about that for a moment, if a AAA borrower and a CCC borrower were treated the same way for capital purposes, one would obviously be paying a much higher interest rate than the other, but the capital is the same. So mm-hmm. the return on equity was much lower for high-grade corporates. And our specialty was dealing with relatively high-quality corporate borrowers. Hence our interest in credit derivatives, which evolved from initially standalone single-name structures to thinking about portfolios of risk, because indeed that's what we were managing. We had portfolios of risk. We didn't just have single exposures. We had large, diversified portfolio. And the fundamental insight associated with the introduction of portfolio credit derivatives or synthetic CDOs or bistros, as the JP Morgan early version of the product was acronymed,
was that stand for anything?
Something incredibly boring like broad index secured trust offering. Classic JP Morgan boring stuff. Yes. So the fundamental insight there was that by creating a diversified portfolio of credit exposure and tranching it, you could use some of the same conceptual logic that had been applied in CLOs or CBOs, collateralized CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, collateralized loan obligations, or collateralized bond obligations. Apply it to synthetic underlying, so credit derivatives instead of the underlying assets themselves, so that instead of having to transfer all those loans to a trust and then pass out the ownership interest in that trust, you could achieve the same thing by buying credit protection from such a trust and leave the loans exactly where they lived. where they had started. Since loans to high-grade corporates are largely undrawn, their commitments as opposed to funded loans, that's particularly meaningful because transferring a commitment as opposed to a funded loan is basically more or less impossible.
So, I'm sorry. So, you're talking about like a credit line?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, our credit exposure. So, let's say go back to my BP example. I have a committed 5-year. This is classic traditional banking activity. I have a committed 5-year facility to BP, or pick your name, and they pay me X basis points every year. And they have the right to draw down on that facility, but typically they wouldn't draw down unless they had a particular need. It might be used as a backstop, for example, against a commercial paper facility, or it might be used for general working capital purposes, or any one of a variety of other things. But that loan, particularly if it was a high-grade borrower, as a high-quality borrower, it would be a standby as opposed to something that was used.
Okay.
But it's still credit risk because I would be obliged to fund it if they needed it.
Right.
And of course, one of the reasons why they might come to need it is because they're running into difficulties. So it's credit risk.
Excuse me. Is this why Bistro could do $700 million of tranches on a $10 billion portfolio because the portfolio was largely loan commitments rather than front-drawn loans?
No. but I'll explain
okay,
why that's...
Fine.
I'll answer
you
your question.
Do that in whatever sequential
order.
So
the drawnness or not of the underlying exposures is only relevant in the sense that it made it easier for us to want to manage those exposures using credit derivative than outright sales or transfers or other mechanisms, traditional securitization mechanisms. That's the only reason why it's really particularly relevant. The fact that we chose to purchase 700 or whatever it was, if I recall it might be roughly $1 billion of a protection on a $10 billion portfolio, maybe it was 700, no change to the argument, as opposed to buying all of that protection.
Internet interventional JP Morgan discussion of Bistro and all of this from
an offering perspective?
No, marketing.
Wow.
There wasn't a date on it, but it was from that era.
That's pretty wild. We weren't really using the internet a lot back then, but anyway.
No, but it's there.
It's found its way there, yeah. Everything's on the internet, including your baby pictures.
Yeah.
So the reason why we chose to purchase is that we defined a $10 billion portfolio, which consisted of exposures that we had, and purchased about, order of magnitude, about $1 billion worth of protection on the first $1 billion worth of loss. So there's your tranching concept that you've obviously come across before. And why did we not buy the $10 billion worth of protection? Well, we didn't really think the chances of there being a credit loss exceeding $1 billion was very likely, because if you do the mental arithmetic, it would require large numbers of diversified, high-grade industrial corporates, in this case in the United States, I think it was all U.S., to simultaneously default. Very hard to imagine an economic scenario where that would happen. So our view was that we were reducing the vast majority, if not to all intents and purposes, all of the economic risk by buying this tranche. And the tranches were sold to various interested parties, with the riskiest piece being the first loss. Well, JP Morgan returned a sliver of first loss, the riskiest next piece being sold to investors, so on and so forth, up the chain to the least risky piece. And all of those tranches were rated using directly analogous methodology to that which had previously been used in the traditional securitization markets. Very, very small intellectual leap to get from rating a CLO to a synthetic CLO, very similar risk.
And so the tranches themselves were funded. It was synthetic in the sense that it referenced a portfolio rather than actually
we created
having
a trust.
Portfolio.
We put, if I remember right, we put U.S. Treasury securities in that trust that matched the tenor of the deal, which I think was 5 years. And we bought protection from that trust. And in the event that that protection was triggered by credit events on the reference portfolio, those treasuries would have been liquidated and the proceeds would have been paid to JP Morgan under the terms of the credit derivatives.
Mm-hmm.
A very simple structure. Why do we do that? Because that immunizes us from the counterparty risk of people that are buying or making these investments, which the purpose of this whole thing is to reduce counterparty risk, not to add to it. So hence that structure.
So the buyers of the tranches would, in effect, be the sellers of protection?
Absolutely correct.
Okay. And so who were the early buyers of the tranches?
So they were a variety of institutional investors who were in their normal course of business typically credit investors. So some of them would be insurance companies of the likes of a life insurance company that invests in corporate bonds, mutual funds. Some of them were monoline insurance companies. Interestingly, one of the early buyers I recall was a monoline insurance company that wasn't writing an insurance policy. They were buying a bond, which is unusual for them.
Mm-hmm.
Their thinking was the same as their usual thinking, just the format was a little different.
Mm-hmm.
So was it just might have been a few banks involved,
okay,
but not many.
So it wasn't just AIG and the AIG.
No. AIG is not involved thus far. The link to AIG is coming in a minute. But
okay.
AIG and all of that was not needed, not particularly involved, aware, certainly, because they're a sophisticated market participant with their eyes open, but otherwise not involved.
Okay.
So the next stage of the process was JP Morgan had purchased this protection via this structured transaction. We'd sold all of those bistro notes and tranches, and we turned our attention to our own banking regulators to say, how would you treat this arrangement for regulatory capital purposes? Because it is our proposition that we have reduced a lot of risk. And therefore, logically, although we acknowledge that it's not contemplated explicit under the banking rules, banking capital rules, logically, there should be some risk reduction. And this led to a period of intense back and forth between ourselves and New York Fed and possibly the Washington Fed around the concept, because this was almost certainly one of the earliest such dialogues between a bank and its regulator about achieving risk-based capital relief using these types of products. And the way that the Fed approached it was very simple, was very Fed-like, very unfantastic, minimizing the innovation required. They said, this looks awfully like a guarantee, a bank guarantee or a letter of credit, this CDS concept. And actually, we have rules for guarantees, and the deal says that if the concept says that if you buy protection in the form of a guarantee from someone on a loan, or if it's insured from someone, then you do what's called risk shifting. You shift the regulatory capital risk weighting from that of the underlying to that of the counterparty. So he said, that's great, in which case we have U.S. Treasury securities in the trust. And the trust, therefore, should achieve a zero risk-based capital rating because that's our counterparty. And they said, we agree, but only for 10%. The portfolio. And we said, but we've reduced 90% of the risk. And they said, there's a problem. You missed the rest. And that led to the invention of the concept of super senior. Super senior was the rest. Hence my discussion with AIG. Said, we have this curious proposition. We need to buy protection on the remaining 90% of this particular portfolio, or approximately 90% of this portfolio. Are you interested for a price? That price they were. That was the introduction of the first ever portfolio credit derivative.
Well, I was going to say, because it was,
as far as I'm aware,
what you were describing earlier was sounds to me like the inverse of the AIG story, which is insuring the top piece and not the bottom piece.
No, so they ended up insuring it is similar to the AIG story. Okay, so just to be clear, we're understanding. We had already insured the bottom piece, or, to be absolutely clear, the riskiest piece.
Right.
We were going to AIG for that point to the limit of the full size of the portfolio. So that's the top piece. That is super senior, and that is indeed the same piece of the capital structure that they later ran into trouble with. The main difference is that, well, several differences, but the most obvious one is the underlying was a diversified pool of high-grade industrial corporates and not anything to do with mortgage-backed securities or anything else mm-hmm. to do with real estate or that mortgage lending.
They were all corporate loans?
Yes.
Okay.
But the reason you went to AIG, among others, was they had a AAA rating, and so because there was a AAA rating, you could get the regulatory capital.
Well, that would be true under Basel II, but at the stage we were operating under Basel I, and actually they, at that stage, offered they had a banking subsidiary, which offered a 20% risk weighting. They indeed had a AAA rating, which got us comfortable from a, you know, why would you do business with this counterparty point of view? But they were that contract was written with a banking subsidiary of theirs.
Oh, and that was important for the regulatory capital
yes.
rules. It had to be
yes.
no risk
that's the rules were, if you're a corporate, you're 100% risk-weighted. If you're a bank, you're 20% risk-weighted. And if you're a sovereign, you're 0% risk-weighted, which if you think about it, is kind of crazy. So that puts Greece and the United States on the same footing, which some would say is appropriate, but let's, you know, to make the point. And makes all banks created equal and better than all corporates. And AIG was had a subsidiary that was a bank. I believe it was a French bank, actually, if I recall.
Banque AIG.
Thank you.
Was that the counterparty then on the first deals?
Pretty certain.
Because it was a bank.
For that very reason.
So the financial products unit then wouldn't have gotten...
No, the financial products unit was where the employees were employed, and they were using that as one of their legal entities.
Banque AIG and FPR. They're linked somehow.
Well, they both. They were both... definitely both guaranteed by the parent, which had the AAA rating. Not familiar with the details of how they ran their business from the inside, but I can tell you that the individuals employed by FP who we were dealing with were able to transact on behalf of the bank, Bonk AIG.
I see. Okay.
Is the following a true statement, that your bistro trade with AIG was the first unfunded super senior?
I don't know. I've heard it said. It's possible. Definitely one of the earliest ones.
So that part of it was unfunded?
Yes.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
And you paid them 3 bps?
I don't remember, but it was not a large number of basis points. I don't know. I don't recall.
But from J.P. Morgan's perspective, you did this for your own regulatory capital relief.
Correct.
Not to stand in the middle and then
correct.
Provide protection
That's
to
correct.
Others in the market.
That's correct. At that capacity, we were acting as a bank buying protection for our own risk management and regulatory capital management purposes.
Did J.P. Morgan ever become the middleman in this market?
Yes. So we
sort of a detour.
It's not a detour. It's
yeah. Once we had achieved this structure for the benefit of our own bank, we talked to other banks about the technology, and in some cases we bought. We sold protection to those banks and then issued bistros into the marketplace referencing those portfolios. And in that context, we became a middleman, exactly as you described.
If you remember, what roughly was the price differential between what you would pay for that protection and then go sell it for?
It was analogous to what you would get paid for structuring a securitization. So, you know, bond fees, a few points.
Okay. Okay. So something like,
a little more than the average, certainly more than the average plain vanilla bond, but in that zip code.
So hypothetically.
You're not going to ask me how much money we made.
No, I'm not. And this isn't really, hypothetically, if AIG or another counterparty had sold the protection for, let's say, between 10 and 15 basis points,
mm-hmm.
and not to J.P. Morgan, to another bank.
Yeah.
And that bank then sold that protection out for something like 250 basis points.
No, that was not. No, that would not be. That would not be realistic.
Okay.
So to explain. In those days, remember the underlyings were diversified, mostly industrial, corporate, some financials, but single name credits.
Right.
The average credit spread in a healthy credit market, which was the case in 1998-99, of high grade corporates was probably somewhere in the 50 basis points zip code, hence the unattractive return on equity. And so when we sold protection to someone on a portfolio, that would have been the zip code of what we would have been charging them. And we may have spent 45 of those basis points on the returns necessary to pay the investors in the resulting bonds, and maybe 5 of those basis points might go to an AIG or super senior risk taker.
Okay.
If it wasn't until the yields on the underlying portfolios evolved, which again I wasn't involved in many years later, that I imagine any of the numbers that you cited could have been in play.
Okay, thanks. So when the Bistro deals, maybe not, J.P. Morgan did the first unfunded super senior deal with AITFP. How did the market evolve from there? Like, what was the volume of those types of deals? Once you saw that it worked and you were able to get regulatory capital relief and you'd gotten an opinion that it was not insurance from the New York State Insurance Department, did the volume of the types of deals referencing industrial corporate single names increase?
A few tens of billions in total, would be my guess.
And then at some point, the market shifts and starts using these same structures for a whole other variety of asset-backed securities.
Correct.
And it's been reported that the J.P. Morgan team actually early on looked at doing this with mortgage debt and was not comfortable doing that. And are you familiar with that? Is that right?
Yes, that's accurate. One of the banks that we were talking to about using similar technology asked us about using it to, instead of hedging their portfolio of corporate loans, hedging their portfolio of investments in securities. As I recall, that was how the topic came up.
Wanted to hedge their portfolio of securities?
Mortgage securities.
Mortgage securities. Which bank was it?
Honestly, I don't recall. Don't recall.
And so
we were having conversations with tens of counterparties, and this deal never came to fruition. So
what was the thinking? What was the analysis that J.P. Morgan did, and timing, if you could, around this? And what was the analysis of why the structure was inappropriate for mortgage debt?
The simplest way to think about it is that securitized products which have been previously tranched, inherent in them have leverage. So if you're buying, for example, a BBB rated tranche of a mortgage-backed security, it represents a small sliver of risk in a large portfolio, but an early piece of the risk in terms of sequencing of who absorbs the first, second, third loss. And let's say you took lots of those BBB rated tranches, added them up and said, oh, does that really look like a diversified portfolio of BBB rated corporate credits? The proper intellectual answer is no, it looks very different. Why? Well, because there are certain commonalities inherent in what would cause trouble for that mortgage security all of those mortgage securities that are highly correlated. For example, if the unemployment rate in the United States went up, that would be a bad thing for performance of residential mortgages. If interest rates were to rally, that could be a bad thing. Depends on a whole bunch, but there, if housing prices were to fall precipitously, which is obviously what's going to happen, not a lot of diversification there. Whereas compared with 100 BBB corporates, you know, one's in oil, one's in insurance, one's in...
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Would the same concept hold if the corporate portfolio was Exxon and BP and Shell? And that was, you mean, well, it was that only, it was at all, that
was
all
only oil.
Oil. Yes, that's what I mean.
There would be a similar concern, which is sensitivity in that case to the oil price.
And maybe. Is that external to whatever models are used to assess this risk?
Shouldn't have been. No, I mean, what that translates to in modeling vernacular is much higher correlation assumptions. So you could reflect that in your model if you liked. If you didn't, you wouldn't get the right result.
Okay.
We did.
Right. And when
I get comfortable.
And when was this that this was first considered?
Well, it must have been before I changed jobs, so before 2001.
Okay.
So just to put a very fine point on this, if I may, it was really your view of correlation rather than the fact that the assets were already securitized.
That's almost one and the same thing, yes, it was our view of correlation, and that was compounded by the fact that the assets were already securitized.
Thank you.
Correlation increases risk in a securitized tranche, generally.
So if you could just help me understand sort of the way that the team at J.P. Morgan thought about this at the time, was this just sort of, yeah, that's obvious. That's something that's not going to work in this structure because there's a high degree of correlation there. And
I think there was some debate. I don't know that it was blindingly obvious. There was some debate.
Because, I mean, the question it leads me to is how did others in the market later on seem to miss this fundamental point?
Hard to know if you weren't there.
Oh, if we weren't at the other banks.
If we, you know, not having been there, it's hard to know how they missed that. It's hard for me to comment. I just recall our experience, and our experience was we definitely had that debate.
Did it ever resurface at any point? I mean, if you can speak to it. I guess you said you were head of credit policy.
I was.
But that was on sort of a different team until 2004.
Of course, yeah.
So if you don't know, that's fine. But if you know or were aware, did the thinking at J.P. Morgan ever get revisited in light of the changing market circumstances when this started to get done in much greater volume with mortgage-backed securities?
I wasn't involved in the discussions in any direct sense, but we certainly saw the activity ongoing in the market. I think it would be a fair presumption to believe that there were discussions about it. The thinking on the risks evolved because as time passed, other concerns arose, including concerns about the risk of a decline in house prices and whether there was a bubble in the housing market. So but that's based on general knowledge of discussions around market conditions rather than a specific knowledge of, gosh, we mustn't do this.
Mm-hmm. J.P. Morgan had an early relationship with AIG FP. I'm wondering if you know if J.P. Morgan's concerns, reservations, or just position on this, that mortgages were sort of inappropriate, was ever discussed with AIG at all?
Not to my recollection. No, we never were discussing anything related to mortgage products with them.
Okay.
Who were some of the other super senior counterparties?
Monoline insurance companies, the Ambax, CapMax, CapMat, it wasn't called CapMat forever, MBIA, I guess, those types. Probably were some banks.
Did JP Morgan ever hold the super senior risk?
Yes. After the first Bistro transaction, the Fed revised their guidance and concluded that without having to purchase the super senior risk on the remaining portfolio, you could achieve a 20% risk rating on it nonetheless. So there was no longer any need to purchase. So that's with respect to when we were doing our own hedging transactions. So after the first deal with AIG, we never needed to do another one for the purpose of our own use. In the case of deals we constructed for other banks, we did retain some, but not an unlimited amount. And I don't recall the numbers involved, but nothing like what you subsequently saw at AIG.
How would JP Morgan have gone about keeping a handle on the risk involved in keeping the super senior on its books?
Was it?
Because the size, I mean, one thing that was completely eye-opening for me when I actually saw how these deals were constructed, completely not being a practitioner, obviously, or having that much knowledge of the financial part of it, that the tranches, you know, I was thinking, okay, AAA, AA, and it's the super senior part is the hugest piece. I mean, it's a substantial piece of the overall, so the notional of the super senior is quite large.
That's right.
So how do you evaluate the risk of that? Even though there's subordination there, there still seems to be a fairly significant risk when you take those on, given the size of the deals that we've seen anyway.
Need a strong risk management culture and controls, and we had that, and that led to questions around how much is too much of anything, irrespective of how safe you think it is. What if you're wrong? It's the sort of question that, you know, you would like a risk management team to ask.
So it was a simple matter of not letting those exposures get too large. So the notional size does matter.
Well, obviously with hindsight, particularly in a concentrated portfolio where you had the correlation risk that I described earlier, which is where things had apparently evolved to by 2008.
One of the things that, this is a much more general point, that people have commented on that I think we're looking at is determining how important the notional size of derivative portfolios are in assessing the risk that exists in that market.
Ah, okay. So now you're going in a different direction. Remember, the notional size...
So is it a different direction?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
It is very importantly a different direction. In the case of what it is commonly understood that AIG did, they wrote protection on approximately $400 billion of mostly mortgage-related underlying portfolios, some corporate as well. That was a one-way bet, in inverted commas, unhedged. And notional counts in that context. The other context in which notional often gets referenced, related to derivatives risk, is that when people add up all the notionals of business transacted in the derivatives markets and say, gosh, that's a scary big number, 50 times the GDP of a small country or something like that. And there what's missing is the fact that we're not talking about one-way bets, buys and sells, portfolio risk. So before you start worrying about notional risk, you have to translate that into risk equivalence. Now, $400 billion of one-way risk of super senior on mortgages is the equivalent of owning $400 billion of AAA mortgage securities, which is a lot of bonds. That amount of offsetting risk in offsetting directions is nothing like as scary. So you have to distinguish. Very important.
So you're not talking past each other. I think the point she was making earlier is that too much of anything is too much. It's not, you were talking about the one asset, but the basic risk management point she was making is, you know what I'm saying?
That yeah, no, I think what you're talking about is, what you're talking about is hedged versus unhedged, it sounds
exactly.
like to me. Or
yeah, so
net
too
versus...
Too much of the one-way bet, which is the AIG situation, you know, is can be too much. How much is too much is an important question to have asked. And, you know, in their diversification matters and asset quality matters, all those things matter. But if you're wrong, are you adequately capitalized to absorb the losses? And how bad could it be? Those are the types of questions. But when people say there's trillions of dollars of derivatives notional outstanding, should we panic? We need to be careful that we don't fuel a fear that is overblown. Because it's not that people have trillions of dollars of AIG-like bets, and I think there's a risk that people assume that that's what one means when you talk about notionals.
How would you advise us in going about figuring out what the actual numbers at risk are? I mean, if you wanted to try to size the market, how would you go about doing that in a way that actually reflects the risk that
so
exists?
There's a fair amount. I would start with the banking regulators. They're a good source of intelligence on this topic.
But they don't cover all the dealers.
No, they don't. But they can give you help yeah. with the methodology, so that the quantitative adjustments that one needs to make, the distinction between notional versus replacement cost after netting, after collateral. There's a lot of factors that you start with a really big number, and by the time you've actually taken into account of these effects, you end up with a much smaller number. And they have data certainly with respect to all of the banks globally. Nowadays, more people are banks than used to be the case. So whilst I take your point, actually, nowadays, they're capturing the vast majority of the people that count. Wasn't true pre-crisis, but nonetheless, it is now true. So I would stick by my recommendation to start with the banking regulators and use their data to distinguish between notional pre-netting, notional post-netting, notional mark-to-market value, and mark-to-market value post-collateral. And all that data is publicly available.
Okay. One of the things, specifically with respect to AIG, that caused a lot of their pain were collateral provisions contained in some of their credit derivative contracts that required them to post collateral, not just on a downgrade, but upon a decline in the mark-to-market value of the underlying assets. Is that typical? Is that a typical credit derivative provision?
Again, you're asking from up time and up to 2001, typical when, typical how?
Sure, well, we could start that way, if you wanted to do pre-2001.
It is the use of collateral arrangements has become more popular with time since the beginning of the derivatives market. Why? Because it's a useful mechanism for managing counterparty credit risk. AIG's arrangements were an example of the breed. What was unusual about AIG's arrangements was not the collateral provisions, it was the one-wayness of the bet and the size of the bet.
So when we're assessing what went wrong at AIG, and I'm asking other people too, I mean, we're trying to get a general sense of people who are knowledgeable in the field. Because we can't go look at every derivative contract, and so we're using this as a bit of a shortcut.
I was commenting about Glide's 2001, what's gone on since then, she knows, but it's not what she does.
Sure. No, I understand that. I appreciate that. Were you surprised when you heard about these provisions in AIG's contracts? No. So this isn't something that would be atypical, necessarily.
Nope.
Although my understanding was that the monolines actually would not post collateral.
Correct.
So a lot of the...
That was by statute. That was really by rating agency statute. They were prohibited from doing that.
Rating agency statute?
Rating agency rated monoline insurance companies and typically would have view on the ability to pledge collateral. It's commonly known.
Dixie, I actually have some other questions.
Go ahead.
I can go in a different direction.
Sure.
So I apologize. I thought I was timely, but you started a little early on me. And I was coming from a meeting downtown. I'm part of the, and if Dixie didn't introduce me, I'm part of the research side rather than the investigative side of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. And just for fuller disclosure, I was a senior managing director at Bear Stearns and did a lot of CLOs and other sorts of structured products. So, and
shame we never met.
Indeed. But in my role with the research group, I do want to shift directions, and this is not about your significant past experience in the derivatives market. This is really more questions of your informed view as a significant person in financial markets, just commenting on bigger picture questions, if you would. One of the things that the Commission is investigating, and we are required to do this by statute, is the role of credit, the role of complex derivatives as potential causes of the financial crisis. So if I could start just with the biggest picture question of, do you believe that derivatives played a role as either a cause or as a propagating mechanism in the financial crisis?
I think, to quote you, I think the better characterization is a propagating mechanism. They transmitted rather than caused. So to be specific, in the case we've been discussing, if you apply a credit derivative to an underlying portfolio of mortgage securities that is inherently going to behave similarly under certain economic conditions, then that weakness in the underlying mortgage securities will be transmitted by the valuation of the derivatives. In this case, house price declines, you know, et cetera, the slowing economy led to that occurring, and the derivatives written on those underlying assets led to losses from the writer of the derivatives, AIG in your example. There are many ways in which financial and other institutions in the economy are interconnected, derivatives being only one of them, others being cross-holdings of debt, tri-party repo system, those types of things, and cross-investments, investors incurring losses in one asset class, having to liquidate assets in another asset class, so on and so forth. So the capacity for contagion in financial markets has increased with globalization. Derivatives are only a part of that. And I think, therefore, that needs to be put into context. The only example that I'm aware of derivatives-related casualty was the AIG casualty, but it wasn't only derivatives that AIG incurred losses associated with. Sec lending, I think, was it? Securities lending was, I think, another major source of loss and another source of interconnectedness in the economy. So that would be my view.
May I ask a clarifying question? Could you distinguish, or do you think it's appropriate to distinguish between CDS used to hedge versus CDS used to speculate?
There is that distinction.
But I mean in terms of its how those different types of derivatives played out in the financial crisis. I mean, because there's some hypothesis that the synthetic, and when I say synthetic, I mean the ones that were used to speculate, the CDS that was used to speculate actually continued to fuel the housing bubble longer than it otherwise would have, because it had this, and it actually created more risk in the economy that was not directly tied to any underlying risk that parties actually held. Therefore, yes, it may be a transfer. It's a leverage point, I think. There's a transfer from one
it's
point.
It's not just a leverage point. It is, but it's not just leverage. It's sort of the amplification discussion, which one can try to unpack as well.
I'm not aware that there was a significant multiplier effect in play. I think the role that derivatives played was in transferring risk that did exist from one party to the next, predominantly, as opposed to creating new or incremental mythical risks. And even to if your logic were correct, if there were structures that were derived from underlyings that were not really there in substantial size, then by construction they didn't lead to creation of debt that was inappropriate.
But they did, because there were people that were going long on the synthetic financial product.
But again, you have to, if your question relates to cause, what led to the decline in value of those products was the inherent underlying credit quality of those products.
I appreciate that. Actually, my question isn't the cause of why the mortgage securities lost value.
Right.
It's the cause of the financial panic in 2008.
So the panic, again, definitely related to the interconnectedness of institutions and or perceptions thereof. And one mechanism that created that interconnectedness was definitely derivatives, along with sec lending, tri-party repo, cross holdings of debt, so on and so forth. The interconnectedness would have been less problematic if it was more transparent than it was. So one of the good things about the financial regulatory reform that is ongoing is that it will impose that transparency on markets where that was not previously the case. That's what I think was the major trigger. It was the fear of the unknown.
I'm taking notes.
So does that mean that the most important problem with derivatives was a lack of transparency?
It's definitely a dimension of it, yes.
What weight would you assign lack of transparency versus the interconnectedness issue versus?
If you had a lot of interconnectedness with no lack of transparency, that wouldn't be a problem, and vice versa. So it's the coexistence of the two.
Okay.
So I'm not sure you can place a mathematical number on that.
Mm-hmm. Stated somewhat differently, but in the same general direction as where Dixie was going with her questions, it is really either in mortgages or also in corporate credit, whether the existence of derivatives somehow led to the bubble, the credit bubble getting larger than it might have without those mechanisms. Do you have a view?
It's possible. It would be hard for me to quantify it.
I agree, it's hard to quantify.
Yeah.
There's one argument is because parties could hedge, it led to greater credit creation.
Yeah.
Although in derivatives, when there's... that's probably an argument more for cash credit creation, so actually real credit creation.
Yeah.
The other part of that argument is just if there's more longs and shorts, there are more people when there are losses who lose, even though there are others who gain because they've bought protection. So there's just more credit risk in the system.
Yeah, that's the interconnectedness. That's that's the counterparty risk between the market participants.
I think I'm making a volume argument or hypothesis rather than just an interconnectedness hypothesis.
The question is?
Yeah.
Did the existence of credit derivatives allow for the just your reaction to the, I mean, there were increases in volumes of a variety of credit derivatives, whether they were single name, whether they were mortgage,
yes,
whether they're indices. There was a lot more of this, what would be termed speculative. A fair amount of it was likely speculative activity rather than hedging an exact position. So was the increase in all of these mechanisms for placing
I think it's the ability to use credit derivatives to place leveraged bets, and the increase in the volume of credit derivatives used for that purpose, and the increase of the potential exposures that were created on the long side that were untied to underlying risk exposure. That there are a whole bunch of people who have now taken short sides and long sides that have no underlying risk exposure one way or the other, that all of a sudden, and they're not just people, they're not just you and me, they're major financial institutions.
All right, so I take a point. Point to remember, it's all a zero-sum game. So for every new long created, there's an offsetting short. Second thing I would say is that it's important to distinguish between a tool and its user. And as I walk away from the financial crisis and think about how could we have done things differently, should have done things differently, that issue is foremost in my mind, in the sense that people lost money because of unwise lending, because of fraud in lending, because of too much leverage in their own balance sheets, because of too much leverage in products, and because of engagement in activities, including but not limited to derivatives, that created risk concentrations that in a violently moving and deteriorating credit environment and confidence environment were problematic. What that doesn't indict all of the tools that were mechanisms for getting into those unfortunate situations.
And perhaps what I'm describing,
in essence, at the core, remember that a mortgage is a simple product. It's a loan, basically a house. And that's at the very, very, very core of this. And yes, there are transmission mechanisms, but securitization was a transmission mechanism. Tri-party repo was a transmission mechanism. And I think the essence of making a good judgment here is understanding that it's the interplay of all of these factors rather than zoning in on just one.
And just so we're clear, my point was not to indict the product. It was to gain a better understanding of how the product was used in a way that exacerbated or led to the financial crisis. And so it's not really a statement one way or the other about the product itself. It's how it was used.
Yes.
And, I mean, one other point that you raised that I'd like to just get your general views on is the role of leverage of financial institutions and the leverage that they took on. I think from our conversation earlier, it seems as though derivatives were one way that they were able to amplify their leverage. Is that right, or is that not a right understanding?
It wouldn't really be my impression. I think
it reduces capital requirements, or it can be used to reduce capital requirements.
Right, but that's reducing risk. So I don't see that. I think the leverage that was became problematic, was good old-fashioned leverage in the sense that you had a certain balance sheet with assets and liabilities and mismatches therein, including tenor mismatches. And those mismatches proved to be too great to be absorbed given the fluctuations in the value of the assets and the loss of confidence. Yeah, you were there.
Yes.
But really, that wasn't really a derivative issue. It was okay. This is our balance sheet. This is our portfolio. This is how we fund it. And looking up and discovering you can't fund it any longer.
Just a little more background about the commission. We've successively tried to examine different products and different elements, and also different institutions. So, one of those that we have not. That we're in the process of more fully examining its derivatives, which is why we're focusing on that. It's not that the others weren't are not areas of inquiry. It's just we need to inquire about this area.
Yes, I understand.
I have one more specific question, and that is the discussion and then the decision that J.P. Morgan made about mortgages being inappropriate for these types of structures back in the late 90s. Are there other asset classes, full stop, that also would not be appropriate for these, or is it a more general point about correlation of
the latter.
Assets?
Yeah, the latter, really.
Okay. So it's not about asset type as much as it's about how correlated those assets are.
Yeah, I think that's right.
That's why I asked my securitized products question. But I think you were saying that in securitized products, something that's already securitized, there's more likely to be high correlation.
Not necessarily, yeah. Yeah, not necessarily.
So I guess I want to ask just one more time, because it's a difficult question to answer and one that economists, I'm sure, will struggle with measuring. But just in your significant historical sense of the development of these products, did the development of credit derivatives lead to more credit creation, more lending?
It's really hard for me to tell. I can't give you a good straight answer to that. It's very hard for me to tell, given where I sit and where I sat. Very hard for me to tell.
Thank you anyway.
Are there any other things that you think it would be helpful for the Commission to understand or to analyze in thinking about the role of derivatives in the financial crisis? And I guess one thing I'll raise, we can table that for a moment, one thing I can raise are the role of other types of derivatives. Some of our commissioners are particularly interested in, there's been a lot of focus on credit default swaps, and we've talked a little bit today about some of the problems that are raised by credit default swaps, being interconnectedness and lack of transparency. Seems that, as a general matter, that those types of issues would also be problematic with respect to all types of derivatives, including interest rates, commodities.
I don't think there's anything special about credit default swaps in that context that would differentiate them from any form of derivative. The need for transparency is the same, whether the underlying is a foreign exchange rate or an interest rate or a credit spread. I also would point out that the form of credit derivatives that we've been mostly talking about, which is the securitized structured products version involving mortgage underlyings, was a very small part of the overall credit derivative business by notional. So that's just worth pointing out. It would almost be more appropriate to call this subpart of it mortgage derivatives than credit derivatives. The vast majority of credit derivatives are indeed single name corporate or corporate index structures. But that's just parlance, I guess.
Indeed. So the reason why most of the focus has been on mortgage-related derivatives is just because there were, even though there was less volume than in corporates, there were greater losses.
And one notable large loss.
In the United States, or not? I mean, there were other losses in Europe and overseas.
Well, it was the asset class itself. Mortgages was the asset class that suffered the greatest deterioration in value. And the derivatives written on that led to losses, in one case, very concentrated losses, larger than sustainable, and hence the need for taxpayer involvement or government involvement.
So back to my earlier question, or slightly earlier question, about other things that the Commission should be thinking about with respect to looking at the role of derivatives in the crisis.
Well, I think you've covered most of the things I thought you were going to ask about. I don't think there's anything you missed. Okay. So let's not forget that they can be helpfully used to manage risks. And an outcome that wouldn't be a good one is if that is prevented in the future. That's where they all started.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.